I thought Benki was boring, and then all of a sudden I find myself in saying that in that place they were talking about everything that was going on in the world, and everything that was going on in the world was reflecting in stocks or currencies, movings, and so I said, oh, this is pretty fun, right? This is really interesting. You are at the center of everything that goes on. And I think in banking today is still the case.
Welcome to Leaders Unplugged. Leaders Unplugged is real talk with the impactful, candid, honest, actionable, and always fresh from behind the scenes, presented by IMD and hosted by IMD's president, David Beck. I'm Felix Zeltner, journalist and founder of Remote Daily, and I have the huge honor to co-host this brand new format together with David. And today, for our second episode, we welcome our first guest. David sat down with no other than Sergio Ermotti, the CEO of UBS and one of the most influential leaders in global finance. In front of a live audience at IMD's home in Lausanne, Switzerland, they talk about everything from the recent takeover of Credit Suisse by UBS, cryptocurrencies, to how Sergio went from being an aspiring soccer player to banker. And right in the beginning, David brought up the question whether UBS is too big for Switzerland and whether Sergio understands, even though he disagrees, why in the public conversation this question just hasn't gone away.
I fully understand. You know, as I mentioned before, it's traumatic and tragic what happened. So people are asking themselves, wait a second, we have been told a few years ago that the new regime and the new regulation would avoid something like that happening, and now here we are again. Well, of course, all of a sudden we have to go through an emergency law over a weekend to rescue a bank. Of course, I understand why people are asking the question. But yeah, that's the reason we have to be serious about how we answer the question and not allow a culture of fear to dominate this debate. Now, if I go down to the classical example, we are too big for the country because the size of our balance sheet is twice the size of the economy. Then I have to say, okay, let's go through the numbers. I fully understand we are, but Switzerland is a country that punches about well above its weight in terms of many dimensions. If I look at the size of the Swiss National Bank balance sheet compared to the GDP, if I look at the debt per capita in Switzerland, you know, many of you I'm sure know, is one of the highest in the world. The debt per capita in Switzerland, okay?
Lots of mortgage owners in the room.
Exactly.
Here. Yes.
So when you look at the size of our balance sheet, you have to say, okay, let's put all these data points, you know, the fact that we per capita have twice as much wealth as any countries around us, or the size of the market cap of the stock exchange in Switzerland is the sum of, I would say Italy, Germany, Spain, and Austria together.
Right. It's more than Germany, right?
Yeah. So that's what I'm always trying to say is, okay, by the way, Switzerland is the 20th largest economy in the world, and we are number 19 as a bank in terms of size in the world. So I'm saying, okay, this is what Switzerland is all about. Now, let's talk about the risk. We have 1.5 trillion of balance sheet. So if you look at the difference between our current balance sheet and what, you know, for example, the financial crisis. Back then, UBS and Credit Suisse combined at 3.7 trillion of balance sheet versus 1.5 today, 2007. Back then, 75% of the balance sheet was in the investment bank. Today, it's 28. 60% of our business is coming from wealth management and asset management, 20% from the Swiss bank, so personal banking and commercial banking, 20% is the investment bank. So 350 billion of the balance sheet are mortgages and credit to Swiss companies. 250 billion is liquidity held at central banks. So if you go through the balance sheet, then you understand why we cannot simply look at the balance sheet of UBS to automatically look at the risk. So fine, I do understand all these risks, and we need to educate people about this issue and not create fears. Actually, what we would have seen if UBS would have not been part of the solution for whatever reason, today you would probably see a Credit Suisse that would be almost like a cantonal bank with some international wealth management businesses attached, right? And this is not my opinion. Every single expert that went through the FSB, the banking expert, and everything has been quite clear. But of course, we would have lost many more jobs in Switzerland. We would have had a huge reputational damage to the country, because nobody would have understood why are you going through a liquidation in such a way that it can create some collateral damages if you have a solution with UBS. That was what happened. So yes, I understand, in conclusion, why people put it that way. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, the public debate is not very balanced in really understanding certain elements of what happened and how, in the unlikely event that UBS goes through a similar issue. We are pretty convinced that, you know, the bank is resolvable, and without the taxpayer having to risk any substantial... actually, I'm convinced taxpayers usually make money out of this exercise. Not that they should make money out of it. It's not a business model, of course, right? but of course, the proof of what I'm saying is that in Switzerland, the last two occasions, you know, the taxpayer made money out of it, which is the proof that the regulatory regime must be good enough. By the way, must be good enough if UBS was able to bail one of the most significant systemic banks in the world within months. We stabilized it. It must be that something is going right somewhere.
I really appreciate how you put this to remind folks that there was an alternative to UBS taking over Credit Suisse, but that in many ways, that alternative would have been you know, less beneficial on a number of dimensions: confidence in the financial center, employment, support for customers, and so on. So I'm going to formulate something now. You don't need to agree with it. But in many ways, you can look at this, and I think some people outside of Switzerland looked at this. It was pretty extraordinary what your colleagues have done. I mean, you can say a massive favor. Again, this is not a word that you would probably use. And yet, your team then has been sort of on the receiving end of some of what you described right now. Is that a challenge when, you know, people have been working incredibly hard to stabilize this other bank, to integrate it, right? This is not something that anybody had on their plan for the year, but you're not exactly being showered with gratitude, it seems like, and people are scrutinizing everything that you're doing. Is that fair? Well, you don't have to say if it's fair, but I'll just put it like that.
It's pretty fair.
It's fair, no?
It's pretty fair.
It's fair.
Yeah. One thing I can tell you for sure, that's for, yeah, of course, you have to have a fiduciary duty on making the right thing for your shareholders, your stakeholders, but also a sense of responsibilities to stepping in and helping the country. And in a sense, you know, I can assure you that, you know, having worked for 9 years to with my team and the rest of the people in the bank to restore confidence in UBS and the Swiss Financial Center, I was very proud to see that UBS was asked to be part of the solution over the weekend. So that for me was closing the chapter of what Switzerland did for UBS during the financial crisis. So in that sense, I was the right thing to do, because the contagion effect, it's fair to say that in a very opportunistic way, the best things to do for UBS would have been to stay out and just get a lot of business within a few months without doing anything. But of course, we would have suffered if Switzerland suffers, because we are interlinked. One and the other goes together. So it was absolutely essential. Now, I have to say that we don't need to be thanked. We don't want to be thanked. We don't want to be loved. We want to be respected. And in that sense, of course, if you look at the debate, you may think that we created a problem. Of course, that's a fair statement. Of course, I agree, because that's the situation we have to now face. And the issue is that, why, I go back to the point, why was Credit Suisse allowed to go on for so long in such a precarious condition without any intervention? That's the question. The markets flagged it already in 2019 and 2020. Just forget just about the stock price, the funding level, the profitability, the reputational issues. Things were going on for years. And then all of a sudden, You think that over 72 hours, you resolve everything?
So we have a number of questions on technology and innovation. You talked about this. Has the integration of Credit Suisse distracted UBS from the pursuit of innovation with technology? Can you speak a little bit about that space? And again, has the integration with Credit Suisse helped? Has it hurt? Has it been neutral in your pursuit of innovation and wealth management in particular?
Oh, of course, it's distracting, and it is impossible to say that it's not affecting us. I mean, the profitability of the bank is, as of today, still well below what UBS standalone had in 2022. Why I talk about that is because, you know, lack of profitability means also, in some cases, lack of resources to invest in your business in the future. Mm-hmm. So although we are comfortable that we are building up the right profitability to do everything, it's impossible not to think that we cannot overspend as we go through all of this. And there is also a capacity issue. So it's not only for myself, but the entire management and the organization cannot embark too many projects for growth or innovation without considering the operational risk that we have to successfully deliver the integration. So yes, there is a distraction. Now, is that some things that I'm concerned about? No, because we know. And actually, we are already discussing and implementing new technology. You know, I mean, of course, artificial intelligence and digital capabilities are at the top of our agenda. So despite everything that goes on, we are rolling out as we speak the largest deployment of Copilot in the financial services industry with 50,000 licenses. We had a couple of capabilities that we have been developing and we are funding in terms of giving our people the best tools to be successful. But having said that, of course, we cannot change the processes of the bank in the middle of the exercise that we go through, because that would create too many risks. So, by the way, we don't need to be the front runner in innovation. We need to be a fast adopter. And if we are a fast adopter, alongside with our franchise and capabilities, we can continue to be competitive.
What might be the impact of AI on wealth management? Clearly, there are some fairly tangible applications around productivity and so on, but what might be some of the more discontinuous changes that the widespread adoption of these technologies might bring to your industry?
Look, I still believe, and when I look at talking to not only in banking, but also in even best-in-class user of AI, the truth of the matter is that 80% of the value creation will come from having a more efficient front-to-back capabilities, eliminating unnecessary steps, controls, and things that humans, over time, when they are solicited to do the same job for too long, with even more data, they become less efficient. So we're going to see a lot of this. We're going to see probably more the middle office function changing in the way they support client-facing activities. So in a nutshell, I would say 80% is going to be efficiency-driven, 20% top line, I would say, in the next 3 to 5 years. So, of course, at the end of the day, you will see probably the ability to serve a larger number of clients, a broader set of clients, by enhancing productivity and effectiveness on how you do things. Now, the real issue is going to be to see how the agent AI topic will develop versus the current Gen AI, which is probably more the one that is of immediate need for us. But it's absolutely clear that if you don't embrace these changes in 10 years' time, you won't be able to compete.
We have a number of questions on tariffs, and you mentioned at the very beginning that you weren't as concerned about the sort of first order impact on UBS, but you were quite concerned about the second order, the global economy, growth, your clients. Give us a bit of your sense of the global economic outlook. How do you look at the risk of now reciprocal tariffs, which of course have already come in, and this risk of a prolonged trade war, as opposed to this being about negotiation and bargaining, and ultimately is going to be short-lived if inflationary pressures lead to U-turns. What's your sense?
Now, look, you know, I have to go back before even the recent developments, and I have to say we are coming out of decades or very long period of de facto benign economic conditions. I think that if you take out the financial crisis and also COVID, which were kind of V-shape crises in which we got used to, you know, some kind of disruption, but also a quick recovery, we haven't seen for a while a classical recession. And if I look at the state of productivity and different economies in the world, you know, changes that we see from coming from China, which is still growing, but much less than before. You know, Europe, we all know the state of the economic situation in Europe. I would have said that without a catalyst, a major catalyst, it would be difficult to restore quality of growth. Now, the catalyst is and could be innovation and technology. How do you enhance productivity? How do you face the issue of you know, lack of demographic supports in many countries? So I was hoping that this could be a catalyst for change, although I'm firmly of the opinion that humans need to go through crisis in order to really change. And so without a true crisis, you don't change. Now, the recent developments, in my point of view, are clearly putting a lot of risk to the positive effect. The speed of change may be overestimated, but the scope of change is underestimated. In 10 years' time, the effect of AI and technology will be so massive that I can be positive about. Mm-hmm. But short term, all these tariffs, yeah, all these geopolitical issues, all this very parochial view of the world are going to create a, you know, tensions. And economic tensions in a fragile geopolitical environment is a very dangerous cocktail.
So let's make the optimistic case for Europe. What is your outlook on the European economy and Europe's leaders focused on the right issues to reignite the kind of growth that we need? Are we working on the right issues?
We are talking about the right issues. I'm not so sure they are working on it. Well, let's see. Maybe it is shock that the U.S. administration is bringing to the table. Maybe a wake-up call. I have to say that I was very disappointed that Europe didn't use as a catalyst for thinking about its future Brexit. Because Brexit was, in fact, a wake-up call, right? So just something that was indicative of a potential ramification going into the rest of Europe. And by now, you know that in different countries in Europe, I mean, I don't know how a vote pro or against Europe would go, right? So in a sense, now with the new developments, one could hope that just purely from a, you know, the current debate around defense may be the triggering point for Europe to understand that it's not enough to be a superpower on paper. It's not enough to have one currency to pretend that you are one economic power. If you don't have a clear defense, a unified defense in this very geopolitical challenging world, if you don't have a clear one voice on foreign policy, it's almost impossible to be a relevant player. It's actually, you know, allowing things to, over time, to go down to the lowest common denominator. And so, you know, I'm afraid that it's only a crisis that can drive changes. Honestly, I think that Europe should take examples from Switzerland and the US, and to some extent to the German system, to have a more federal approach to its policy.
How does a proposed capital markets union fit into that? Is that one of the things where the benefits of scale are just so compelling that national interests need to move to second row?
First of all, I think that if the problem of Europe would be only around capital markets and banking union, it would be already a good news, because I mean the problem is that there is way too much bureaucracy and rules coming affecting every single industry in Europe, and if you look at the recent directive on climate that they've been rolling out, they are really affecting small and medium-sized companies to a way that is, you know, it's not only a matter of money, they don't have the capacity to absorb and manage all the requirements that are coming from an administrative standpoint of view. The banking union and the capital market union are necessary. You know that in Europe, including Switzerland, 70% of the financing of the economy goes through the banking system. In the US, it's exactly the other way around. Capital markets, and so a broader spectrum of investors finance changes in the economy. So the need of a capital market union is only there for one simple example: leveraging as much as you can savings, institutional and private savings, into pocket of investments that are designed or calibrated to the risk appetite of the various investors, so that you free up resources in the banking balance sheet to take on different assets, like in the US.
Mm-hmm. And what might be if, because of this emergency as you described it, and the need to fund the increase in defense spending and to generate the kind of growth that would permit us to do that, right? All of a sudden, this capital market union does pick up much more momentum. What might be the implication for Switzerland, and what might be the implication for Swiss-based banks?
I guess Swiss banks are quite well equipped to be part of it. And if you look at the amount of wealth that we manage out of Switzerland, you know, this can be mobilized also towards investing in certain opportunities in Europe. I mean, of course, right now, everything goes into the U.S. I mean, if you think about the U.S., it accounts for 65% of the market cap in the world.
Global equity markets, yeah.
And if you look at valuations and opportunities to invest, I'm pretty sure that if investors would have a good liquid markets and opportunities coming out of Europe, they would divert a lot of these investments back into Europe. So Switzerland can be, you know, as a big investor, as a big wealth management center, can be part of this solution and in helping clients to take advantage of that and helping corporates to access capital markets.
Very good. We have a number of questions on cryptocurrency. What's your take on crypto? How do you and your colleagues think about crypto as an asset class, as a phenomenon?
You know, the crypto is quite clear that we have been quite, you know, cautious and careful around embracing cryptocurrencies, particularly because it's clear that a few years ago and even today, you know, one of the major beneficiary and user of these currencies was the criminality, right? So, and from our standpoint of view, we were, and I was totally paranoid about being dragged into some kind of anti-money laundering issues in which you are helping converting crypto into fiat currencies through the banking system, right? So for us, it was almost like, okay, whatever the opportunity cost, I can assure you that the cost of doing something's wrong, financially and reputationally for us, is huge. So I always say, okay, let's see how it develops. Now, speculation has played a very big role. But now, in the last 12 months or so, I also understand maybe one aspect that is becoming a reality, that in many countries, particularly in emerging countries with high inflation or high political instability, it's becoming very difficult to store away money, cash, without creating some other collateral risk. And in some cases, people are saying, you know what? Maybe cryptocurrencies are not such a bad way to diversify, because the risk of owning cash or bonds or so on, in any case, or government bonds, and the risk of confiscation is very high. Yeah. So we will see. But for me, to be an asset, the level of transparency and volatility on the underlying assets has to be different than the one I'm saying today.
Yeah.
Only then I can really call it an asset class.
Yeah.
So the technology underpinning cryptos is the future.
Yeah.
That's clear.
Very good. When Russia invaded Ukraine, of course, there was tremendous pressure on financial institutions in the West to freeze assets. And of course, that affected Swiss banks as well. it seems likely in this current geopolitical environment that the global financial networks will become increasingly perhaps weaponized, politicized. How do you prepare for that? How do you think about this? How do you sort of balance the various stakeholders, your commitment to your customers, your home market and its political norms and traditions, but also some of those pressures from governments elsewhere?
At the end of the day, we always have to fulfill legal requirements. I mean, when you talk about sanctions and things that goes on, if we operate in the US, in Switzerland, in Europe, in the UK, wherever, in Asia, we need to operate according to the rules decided by the country in which we operate. We cannot do anything else. So it's a reality. And the real challenge for us is to make sure that people, you know, don't shoot the messenger. People can then argue about, do you want to do business with certain people or not? Yeah, that's a bank decision. By the way, it's not even easy that way. Nowadays, rightly so, you want to also avoid discrimination of people. So it's a very challenging environment. Mm. I mean, the problem is not just the fact that things are changing overnight, one way or the other, in the last few years, is that different countries have different rules. And if you are a global bank, trying to really connect this in your booking centers by currency, I mean, there is a huge complication. So it's very, very challenging for us. And it's going to become, as you mentioned, used for political reasons. And, you know, what we need to do is to just be very strict in adhering to the legal requirements.
Mm. I'd love to conclude with just a couple of questions that would give you an opportunity to give some advice. What has served you well in your career in terms of as you made decisions about where to go, what opportunity to take?
Well, I guess the most important one when you are there at that point in time, it means you went through a couple of other processes, but I would say courage.
Mm-hmm.
Courage is to take on a challenge or go out of a comfort zone. Yeah, I mean, that one is important. Of course, my view is on the matter is that this is only most likely the last one, because before then you need to be, skilled. You have to have some skills. You have to have passion. Perseverance is very important. You need to be lucky, right? And you need to understand you are lucky at that point in time. And then you have to have the courage to take actions. And the most important one, I would say, if I think about my career, in some cases I had moment where I had to exercise positive courage and moment in which I had to use negative courage, meaning in responding to a negative situation, I needed to take actions that meant creating a huge discontinuity for me, yeah. Right? And leaving something that I like to do because I couldn't stand certain situations, right? So that's also courage, right?
Yeah, I mean, things were going well just before that weekend, right? When you got that phone call, but of course you had the courage to come back. Make a case for banking. Why is banking such a great sector to be in? You've spent your life in banking. What do you like about banking?
Banking in a broader, I mean, it's now broader, but it's still the same that made me change my plan B. When I was 15, I started as an apprentice and, I did the apprenticeship in banking because I wanted to be a professional football player. But then my plan B was to become a sport teacher, and I wanted to go to Macolin when I was 18. So I needed to do some things in between, and then all of a sudden, banking was the right thing to do. But I was lucky that I got assigned to the securities department in which they were trading stocks and bonds and so on and so forth. So I got totally fascinated, you know. I thought banking was boring, and then all of a sudden I find myself in saying that in that place, they were talking about everything that was going on in the world, and everything that was going on in the world was reflecting in stocks or currencies, movings, and so I said, wow, this is pretty fun, right? This is really interesting. You are at the center of everything that goes on. And I think in banking today, is still the case.
Mm.
You have a chance to really see many, many aspects of the world. The economy is almost, you know, you are at the center. In a broader case right now, not only banking, is in my point of view, one of the vital elements of a well-prospering economy. And so if you are passionate about it, I would say do it. So it's still good.
Okay, great. Final question. So now you made the case why banking is great. Make the case why the MBAs here in the room who are passionate or who are interested in banking should apply to UBS.
I started with 15, and I was fascinated when I saw the first fax machine. Okay? So
it was pretty cool when the paper came out.
No, but what I'm telling you is that if you go back and you would tell people, this is the amount of changes you're going to see in banking because of technology, probably people would have thought, oh my God, we're going to all lose our jobs. And I'm saying right now, we're going to see a lot of technological changes, but I'm still convinced that it's not only going to be capital and risk management, but also people. AI is a combination of IQ,
right,
knowledge, but also a combination where the EQ element,
mm-hmm,
and the human element will play a role. So that's the reason why banking will continue to be a people business. Of course, in a different way and in a way that evolves. And so it's still, for young people that wants to go through a career in which you're most likely going to change your job. I mean, the truth of the matter is that you need to have an intellectual ability to constantly learn and evolve. And I think in banking, it's a good place to go. So, of course, I'm biased, but I do believe that the formal education is only part, mm-hmm, of success. You need to continue to invest in yourself. And very importantly, an MBA is doing that. So I have to say, it's great because people are spending time to invest in themselves and not allowing or pretending that your employer has to do it for you, or even worse, when people pretend that the state is doing it for you, right? And the beauty of a large organization like UBS is the ability to do a career and doing different things, you know, without changing the employer.
Thank you for listening to Leaders Unplugged, presented by IMD in collaboration with Remote Daily. See you in 2 weeks.